funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How are gasoline prices affecting your life right now? We tend not to obsess about what we pay at the pump in times like these, when the nationwide average price for a gallon is $2.54 and the statewide average just $2.42. But few motorists can forget the soaring prices of last summer, when prices were nearly twice what they are now, and we cut back drastically on our driving. My guest this hour believes that shocking summer of 2008 was only a preview, and a mild one at that, of what is to come. And although he doesn't believe we can do anything to prevent the demise of cheap and plentiful petroleum, he is also not convinced we will regret it much. Christopher Steiner is a staff writer for Forbes magazine who originally trained as a civil engineer. His new book is called $20 per Gallon, How the Inevitable Rise in the Price of Gasoline Will Change Our Lives for the Better. Chris, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks, Chris.
I want to start with this. Why are gas prices such an emotional issue for Americans as opposed to simply an economic one?
You know, that's a very good question, and I don't have an answer for you. I think you'd have to ask an economist or maybe a psychologist who studied it. It's a very emotional thing. I've been on a few other shows, and the kind of callers we get, I mean, they're all over the place. As far as some people are really happy about high prices. Obviously, we don't really have them right now. Some people are, they get very angry. I mean, they feel it's an assault to their way of life, and they feel that the government, it should do more to control prices, et cetera, et cetera. People, when they pull up to the gas pump, they see the money they're spending, and that stays with them all day after they fill up. And then they know they have to go do it again and do it again and do it again. So it's a very visceral gut reaction to a price at the pump. So we feel comforted by low prices, and we feel assaulted, in a way, by high prices.
And as you demonstrate in the book, although we think of this as about how we get around, the price of a barrel of oil affects far more than just what we spend on transportation. Can you remind us of the number of daily sort of interactions we have with petroleum products?
Well, probably just about everything you do is related to petroleum, whether it's just the stuff in the office or in your house that you're looking at now, be it your desk that's made out of a wood laminate that's mostly glue that came from petroleum, the paint on the walls, the ceiling tiles, the carpet that's made out of fibers that came from a petroleum refinery, when you're riding on the highway. I mean, obviously you're burning gas in your car, but you're also rolling across this great road that was made from asphalt, which just comes out of the same process that makes gasoline. It's just further down in the refining barrel, so to speak. And not to mention that all the machines and all the things that brought all those materials to that spot used gasoline.
And it really took me by surprise to think about this, but our oil infrastructure is also aging and outdated in many cases. Does it make sense for us to spend a lot of money and effort modernizing what we have right now?
Well, certainly we have to keep it up because we're not going to get off of oil anytime soon. I think everybody realizes that. But the problem is that, you know, some of the megastructures, so to speak, that were built to carry this petroleum all over the world, and it's a lot of it down in Texas, actually, and Matthew Simmons, who's investment banker down in Houston, has written on this extensively about all this infrastructure that is in Texas that brings the crude out of the ports and out of the wells. This stuff, a lot of it was built 20, 30 years ago. It's falling apart. There have been accidents in the last 10 years already, and we saw what hurricanes can do to the price of gas, and we're very close to a couple other catastrophes, really, setting us into a spiral as far as gas prices go. But of course, those have nothing to do with the general idea of peak oil, which really is what's going to drive higher prices in the future.
And even when we were at our all-time high in terms of prices last summer, gas was still cheaper per gallon than milk or soda or bottled water. It still remains a pretty cheap commodity today.
Well, when you think about what you get out of a gallon of gasoline, it's very cheap. $2.50. And there's nothing that we pull out of the ground more easily than oil. And there's nothing that we found thus far, I mean, outside of, radioactive isotopes, that carries that kind of energy in that kind of small space.
Inevitably, our economy will rebound, although sometimes it seems like it's going to be decades in the future. But at what point in that rebound do you think we'll experience our next big shock of rising prices?
Well, I think that if we do manage to get out of this, and let's hope it happens in the next 9-10 months, you know, I think we could see we'll be back to $4 within 2 years, and we could see $6 within 3 to 4 years. And of course, those kinds of prices not only do they affect us at the pump, but of course they will put the brakes on any type of economic recovery. So the key to economic growth in the future, long term, is finding out ways to use less gasoline and mitigate our dependency on oil.
Christopher Steiner is my guest. His new book is called $20 per Gallon, How the Inevitable Rise in the Price of Gasoline Will Change Our Lives for the Better. So I think nationwide we made some really significant cuts in the way we travel at $4 a gallon. You see $6, though, as the first price point that truly shocks us into what will be permanent change. For one thing, the death of the SUV.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the SUV is still going strong. Certainly, it's not the American standard that it was 3 or 4 years ago. I mean, that seemed to be the car of first choice for most people not long ago, before last summer. And the reason I say $6 is going to be this giant turning point is because we have already seen $4 all across the country. If we get back there, I think people certainly will complain, but nobody will be shocked. I mean, we've been there before. And, you know, we survived and we kept going. Now, granted, we made giant adjustments last year. We drove 100 billion less miles in America in 2008 than we did in 2007. That's the only kind of that's the only drop we've ever had of that magnitude. As far as usually we drive more miles every year. And so we had a giant drop last year, and that was due to the price of gas. And so at $6, you'll see, you know, that those kinds of effects extrapolated even further. Not to mention that I think a switch will go off in most people's heads, a tipping point, so to speak, and they'll say, you know what, we're not going back to two. This is different. We have to change how we live, and I think people will start to change indelibly when they make a life choice, whether it's to move further out into exurbia or move further toward the city or live in a smaller house or, you know, live in a more walkable neighborhood. I think those types of decisions are really going to start to be affected at $6 per gallon gas.
And it certainly does seem that in addition to the economic, to the environmental benefits, rather, that we might see if gasoline were this expensive, as we saw last summer, there will be fewer road deaths.
Well, it's amazing the effect that the price of gas has on the number of road fatalities. There's a professor at Harvard, Daniel Grabowski, who linked the price of gas to the number of road fatalities. And basically, the lower the price of gas is, the more people die in the roads because people drive more, they go further out, they take more road trips, they drive faster when the price of gas is lower. And so for each dollar that the price of gas goes up, we save 11,000 lives on the road for each dollar that it goes up. I mean, that's an amazing statistic. So at $6 per gallon compared to, say, with current prices, we'd save 16,000 lives. At $8 per gallon, that's 20,000 lives. We lose over 45,000 people on our roads to road crashes every year.
So we saw last year people who were already maybe inclined to walk or bike places doing so. Is $6 or $8 the point at which people who would never have considered taking their bike to the grocery store with a basket on the back suddenly finding themselves on a two-wheeled vehicle getting around by the power of their own bodies?
Absolutely. And I think a lot of people started doing that type of thing last year. And even as the price of gas has gone down, most of those people haven't gone back to the old way of getting in the car. They found that, you know, riding the bike, A, it gives them exercise. B, if the weather's okay, it's very enjoyable. I mean, you really feel like you accomplished something. And, you know, as long as the grocery store isn't 8 miles away, it doesn't really take any less time. In fact, it can be even faster depending on the kind of traffic flows in your neighborhood.
Well, the book is a real reminder of the critical nature of location, which has always been a big deal in real estate. But suddenly, living far out in the suburbs or the exurbs, as you mentioned, it becomes far less attractive.
Well, and we've seen that as we've lived through this real estate crash over the last 2 years. We've seen values at the edges of suburbia crash harder and stay down longer than we have in the areas closer to city cores, closer to walkable neighborhoods. Now, everything generally has been down. But it's those communities of density that have recovered faster and didn't fall as far. And I think that's a trend you're going to see continue to be exacerbated in the future.
So I guess cheap housing ultimately just isn't such a bargain when you're spending all that money and more getting to and from where you need to be every day.
Well, you know, people didn't really work in the price of driving everywhere and driving far when they used to buy a house, say, 40 miles from their job. It wasn't a big deal. What was more important to them was getting in a comfortable 3,000-square-foot home where the whole family loved this place. It had all sorts of bells and whistles, and we can all appreciate that. We all have that desire to live in that type of house. But we're no longer going to be able to write off the price of transportation as negligible, you know, as commuting 50 miles, not to mention that it's a real wear on you. But money-wise, paying that kind of price for gasoline, you know, at $3 or $4 or $6 or $8 per gallon, it's just not going to be a tenable option for most people in the future.
So how are we going to get around beyond simply more biking and more walking?
Well, certainly cars aren't going to go away, and gas cars aren't going to go away. You'll see more efficient cars. You see smaller cars. We will see the electric car. But I think it's important to realize that we're not going to be able to just switch out all our cars for electric cars overnight, and not even in 10 or 20 years. There's over 200 million vehicles in America right now. Even if we made 5 million electric vehicles a year, it'd take over 40, and that's a giant number, by the way. I mean, we can't even sniff that right now. It would take us 40 years to replace all our vehicles with electric vehicles. So, I mean, people are going to take the path of least resistance. I mean, you know, when they get to a transitional point in their life and say the price of gas is $6 a gallon, and they live maybe, you know, I live in Chicago, but maybe they live out the edge of Chicago in a place beyond the suburb we call Naperville here. You know, they're 50, 60 miles outside the central city. Next time they decide to move, maybe they're like, you know, let's move in 30 miles to a place where there's a little more density. We're going to live in a townhouse. We're still going to have a nice house, but our kids are going to be walked to school. We can walk to a train, and we can walk to a grocery store. And that's a great way to live.
What role do you think that toll roads will take in transportation infrastructure?
Well, we're facing a problem right now with the federal gas tax, as you may or may not know. It's basically not high enough. We're running a deficit in the Highway Trust Fund. It's about to go bankrupt. Congress put $8 billion into it last year because it went bankrupt again last year. And that was the first time that had happened in a long time. The federal gas tax of 18.4 cents was set in the early 90s, back when the price of gas was about a dollar. The problem is that last year, when we drove 100 billion less miles, we bought that much less gasoline. And so Congress collected that much less revenue of worth of gas tax. But yet, when the price of gas goes up, the price of building roads goes up at almost the same rate. So right when they needed more money to keep up all these highways, they got less. And so they're looking for solutions to this right now. And the obvious solution is to raise the gas tax. But that is a political cyanide pill that nobody wants to take. And so one of the ways they might mitigate this problem is by just instituting tolls all over the place, whether it's by the mile or just per road that you drive on. I don't know how they're going to do it, but certainly toll roads, and I've seen this in Chicago big time. I mean, the city here sold the Chicago Skyway, which goes over to Northwest Indiana. It's a very short road, but they sold it for $2 billion. They gave a foreign company rights to toll there for the next 100 years in exchange for them having to keep up the road.
Christopher Steiner is my guest. He's a staff writer for Forbes magazine. His new book is called $20 per Gallon, How the Inevitable Rise in the Price of Gasoline Will Change Our Lives for the Better. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. If you'd like to join us after the break, you can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Christopher Steiner. He is a staff writer for Forbes magazine with a background in civil engineering. His new book is called $20 per Gallon, How the Inevitable Rise in the Price of Gasoline Will Change Our Lives for the Better. You can join us via email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Chris, you see cities like Dallas as being in a relatively good position to weather what's to come. Can you talk about what we've got going in our favor here?
Well, Dallas, Dallas has in its favor is that they have a lot of people that I would assume are going to want to stay there. What's not in Dallas's favor is the fact that those people generally are spread out over very large territory. Dallas has been built on the automobile by and large. I mean, I am not an expert on Dallas, but I've been there a few times, and I think most people would agree that that's a metropolitan area that's been tailored to the car. Now, most of them are. Dallas is not. I'm not singling them out here. Certainly, the older the metro area is, the more less dependent people are in the car. But I think in the Dallas metro, you're talking about 3,500 people per square mile or so. Now, comparing that with to the polar opposite, of course, would be New York at 27,000 people per square mile. And on the island of Manhattan, of course, you have 70,000 people per square mile. But Dallas has some nice features in that it has these radiating interstates that come out of the city all over the place. And, you know, those may not be ridden to the extent that they are now in the future, but those give us great right-of-ways to, say, put in a train line, be it light rail or a subway or whatever, in lieu of another lane of traffic. And we can build up densities along those roadways without, of course, evicting people out of homes and stuff like that. So those types of roadways are going to be used in the future. And I think Dallas, in the last building boom, has saw some very large condo towers go up downtown. And, you know, those are the type of things that, you know, they may be even flopping right now as far as the value goes, but those are the places that are going to profit in the future.
And at what point do you see, because I think this is a really interesting element of the book, suburban land that is currently full of neighborhoods being turned back into farmland?
Well, you know, at the very edges of exurbia, basically where, you know, pavement meets cropland, I think those places could go back all the cropland in the future. I mean, the bad news is that we're going to see erasures of equity, so to speak, of people who own homes out there. Now, if you live there now, I suppose this is something you should worry about, but the good news is that this isn't going to happen next year. But in the future, it's going to happen. I mean, similarly to the way we saw people lose their equity in places like St. Louis and Detroit and Pittsburgh as people went to the suburbs from those central cities 30, 40 years ago, you're going to see the opposite take place in places on the far edges of Chicago, Dallas, Houston, etc. So, and the other good news is that most of these homes aren't built very well. And there's a great book called The World Without Us by Alan Weisman that just imagines a world where we all disappear. What would happen? And one of the chapters is on the basic generic suburban house. And, you know, that thing doesn't stay standing very long when there's not someone there to keep it up. And is some of those neighborhoods empty out, and they eventually will, you know, those houses are just going to fall down.
One thing that would put us in this part of the country in a tough spot is the demise of the airline industry, which is struggling mightily even now. How high do fuel prices have to go to keep us from flying and to really take down some of the legacy airlines, including American, which is based here?
Right. That's a good question. And, you know, I forecasted the utter remaking of our skies at $8 per gallon in the book. Now, we may see that happen before then, frankly, if we stay in this economic malaise much longer. I mean, United's on the doorstep again. Now, they're based here in Chicago. American has been more deft in their decisions than United generally, so they've stayed out of trouble. But, you know, American's looking at, I think, at a balance sheet of over $20 billion in debt. You know, they're not lined up well for this either. What's going to happen is the price of gas goes up and up and up. These models that the airlines have built based on basically spending 10% of their operating expenses on gasoline, on jet fuel, that just doesn't work. I mean, last year when gas was $4 a gallon, airlines were spending 40% of their operating expenses on jet fuel. I mean, they were losing money hand over fist, and it's going to get even worse. worse. And so what you're going to see is that most of the legacies, American included, will go out of business, and, you know, assuming the government lets them. And we'll see Southwest, of course, that is a Texas company. We'll see Southwest and JetBlue probably take over the domestic traffic. Now, another Texas company, Continental, looks to be in the best shape for a future of higher jet fuel prices, and they could ultimately become the one international carrier of consequence from the United States. But the thing is, right now we kind of get into planes like we're jumping into a cab. We fly, I mean, I fly from Chicago to San Francisco, it's $300 or less a lot of the times. I mean, which for, you know, an upper middle class person isn't that much money. And it used to be a lot more, if you recall, in the 70s and 80s. Flying wasn't as easy as it was now. And that's because we just have way too much capacity, and that capacity is going to be cut in half by the time we get to $6 or $8 per gallon.
And not nearly so many short-haul flights, so we won't fly from Dallas to San Antonio.
No, no, you won't. And I think people, a lot of people don't like doing that now, just because by the time you go through security and all the rigmarole involved in going on an airliner these days, you might as well just drive.
Yeah,
and I know Texas, just like here in the Midwest, has looked at, you know, building their own rail system, high-speed rail system. And what a wonderful thing that would be across the state of Texas to have. And I think those are the types of realities that are going to come into play when gas prices get higher and the airlines start to disappear and stop being a normal option for normal people. You know, people are going to demand high-speed trains. And, I mean, just imagine getting on a train in Houston and getting off in Dallas just a few hours later. You know, I mean, it'd be a wonderful thing. And even here on the in the Midwest and the East Coast, I mean, there are technologies right now that are, exist that, you know, in places like Spain, where you could get on a train in downtown Chicago and get off in midtown Manhattan 7 hours later. I mean, it takes me longer to go from each place because I got to fight out to each respective airport on a plane.
Christopher Steiner is my guest. His new book is called $20 per Gallon. Our number, 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Bill in University Park. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I have a couple of questions. Motorcycles, how do you see them playing a larger role? And at what point, let's say, does the cost of auto insurance drop to reflect the scarcity of automobiles and maybe push people towards motorcycles a little more? And then the other question is, let's say you've got a vacation property that's a three-hour drive from where you live now. What's going to happen to the it's totally rural. What's going to happen to the value of those? Will that still be considered close enough when gas is $10, $20 a gallon? Or will those be will drop in price to reflect the people not wanting to drive that far?
Those are both great questions, and I think, you know, if you've spent any time in Europe, you see a lot more scooters and small motorbikes than you do generally in American cities, and that's because the price of gas over there is generally two or three times as much as it is here. And so certainly motorcycles are very efficient on gasoline. Even the big, you know, honkers get you 50 miles per gallon, and the nimble ones will get you close to 100 miles per gallon. So I certainly think you'll see more people on motorcycles. I certainly see more Vespas around Chicago than I used to, more little Honda scooters as well. And as far as the resort town thing, your question, that's a great question, and it is something I address in the book. There's a section of the book about resort towns. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I think, you know, places that are closer to metro areas like Dallas or like Chicago or like New York are going to be okay. Places that are within 3 hours, I think they may even see demand for properties in those places go up because people are going to want to stay closer. So, yeah, you do have to drive through hours, but it sure beats getting on a plane with the whole family to go across the country or driving 7 or 8 hours, which some people do right now from Chicago if they go to, say, northern Michigan. That's how far they drive. And, you know, that's 2.5 times as long as 3 hours. So but it'll also be interesting to see destination resort towns, places like Aspen and Vail and Crested Butte and Jackson Hole, Wyoming. What's going to happen to them? Because those places live on the airlines, basically. And I think you've already seen that some of those resort towns have been overbuilt. You know, you can't have 30 top-tier resort towns in America, even at current gas prices. It's too many. I mean, Crested Butte was way overbuilt, for instance. I mean, real estate was changing hands at prices that were reminiscent of Aspen, even though this is 5 or 6 years ago, even though Crested Butte before then was just a sleepy little ski town. And I think prices there have crashed since then because there's just not enough people with enough money to pay the same type of million-dollar home prices in Crested Butte as they're getting in places like Aspen and Jackson Hole, Wyoming. So as the price of gas goes up, I think you'll see those secondary ski towns and resort towns, be they beach or ski or whatever, be hurt even more. I think Aspen will always be a beacon just because it is what it is. But I think those middling resort towns are going to see their property levels decrease quite a bit.
And in terms of activities, once people do get to those places, do you think $10 a gallon is pretty much the end of snowmobiles and jet skis?
Well, you know, barring a new technology on that front, I think, you know, people aren't going to want to surrender $100 or $150 for an afternoon of fun on a jet ski, just because those things do eat gasoline. I mean, they're great little toys, but they just chew through it. And not, you know, they're expensive to begin with to get your hands on, but then if you're operating it all week and it costs you $500 or $600 to do it, I think they're going to be truly a province of the rich.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Greenville and speak with John. Hey, John.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Yes, sir. I just had wanted to make a couple of comments and then listen to you comment, sir. I have not read your book, but I would like to, but just going by the tone that's presented here, I don't share the optimism that I seem to hear regarding gas going up to the degree that you're talking of. In my estimation, if gas gets to $8 a gallon, I just don't see this transition that you talk about happening. I see a complete retreat of the American consumer and spender, and extreme. I mean, we think high unemployment now. I mean, it would be totally devastating to the American economy for gas to go to where you're saying it's going to go. And it very well may do that, but I'm just don't share the optimism that you have about this transition that we could see or hope for. For food prices, all the different products, like you just mentioned, jet skis, all these different things that we take, you know, that feed into the American economy, but the consumer buying these things and keep all that would be gone away. It'd be done away with. And I just don't. So I guess I just don't share that optimism. I guess my next comment would be that really what we should have done and should be doing is just building nuclear power plants out the wazoo all over this country and just going electric. Should have started 20 years ago, but we didn't do that. And I don't see nearly enough as much hype is talked about. I don't see nearly enough talk about that. That is really the only solution, technologically speaking, that we have.
Well, John,
solar and wind is not going to do it.
Nuclear does come up in Chris's book, and I want to make sure he has a chance to respond before we have to go to break. So thanks so much for your call.
I'd like to listen, sure.
John, there's a lot of people who share your outlook. I mean, as far as, say, $8 of gas being a total wrecking ball for the American economy. And let me make it clear, if we woke up tomorrow and gas were $8 or $9 a gallon, it would be a disaster for the American economy. I think what we have to remember is that there's still 85 million barrels, roughly, per day of oil coming out of the ground in the world. We're not going to drop to 25 million barrels tomorrow. This is going to be a slow decline, and that's going to give us time to adjust. And the American economy will adjust. I mean, Europeans don't live in a ruined economy. Germany's the largest exporter in the world. They have gas prices more than double ours here. So they inherited a whole ruined state in East Germany, and they still have a very vibrant economy. So there are ways to deal with this. The important thing, I think, is to realize that we're hopefully going to have a slow increase of gas prices as the years wear on. As you said, if we go to $8 tomorrow, it will be a disaster. But as things like snowmobiles and jet skis fall away from the American economy, new demands from consumers will pop up, and companies will move in to fill those voids. Just like people demanded exorbitant housing, and contractors and builders rushed to fill that void and made money on it, people will want more walkable communities, and those will be built out of demand. Developers will fill the demand. And just like electric cars, we're going to build those in the future. Now, we may see companies go under. I mean, you know, certainly we've already seen the auto companies falter, the airlines could go. I mean, there's going to be great destruction here, absolutely, you know, as legacy businesses can't cope with changing paradigms. But new Microsofts, new Googles will come in to our world and power our economy forward. I think people underestimate our ability to adapt, and they kind of forget that this has already been done in some ways, but not in all ways, in Europe, in that, you know, they changed their economy. Now, their lives are very similar to ours, really, but they use about half as much fuel as we do per capita. And, you know, a lot of the things they have we'll get, you know, as far as high-speed trains go, more local food networks, et cetera, et cetera.
There is not a great deal of manufacturing taking place in Europe right now, but you do think that the American manufacturing sector could spring back if it's expensive enough to import the goods that we're buying now from overseas.
Well, definitely. I mean, you talk about moving a container, and the container ship is what revolutionized global trade. I mean, it's an amazing story of just how being able to sort and carry stuff over in tabulated containers enabled the rise of China, so to speak. And so basically what it comes down to is the price of moving a container across the ocean. And right now that's probably about $4,000 or $5,000. You know, as we get to $10, $12 per gallon, maybe in a decade or two, maybe in just a decade and a half, you start to talk about prices of $10, $12, $15,000 per container. You'll start to see fewer businesses move overseas. And not only that, at some point, you will see people bring manufacturing back to the United States because here, you know, eventually we're going to have electrified rails that can run on stuff like nuclear, like John was talking about. And the price of moving stuff across an ocean out of this crazy thing that China is will go up exponentially, and the price of moving stuff on our continent will go down. So American manufacturing does have a future in a world of higher gas prices.
We'll be back in the next segment with Christopher Steiner, whose new book is called $20 per Gallon, How the Inevitable Rise in the Price of Gasoline Will Change Our Lives for the Better. You can join us by sending an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Christopher Steiner, who is a staff writer for Forbes magazine. His new book is called $20 per Gallon, How the Inevitable Rise in the Price of Gasoline Will Change Our Lives for the Better. I'm curious, Chris, what you think about the American export business. If it's too expensive for us to import products from overseas, will we also not be able to sell our goods elsewhere?
Well, some goods that don't have a lot of value added, those are going to be the hard ones to move, but fortunately, I mean, we don't. Well, we do. I suppose we have a lot of agricultural products that we move, but I mean, it'll be interesting to see. I think, but really, America stands at an advantage if transport costs are higher, just because our trade deficit is so weighted in what you would consider the wrong direction that we may lose exports, be it in steel or grain. But what we gain and what comes back will more than offset that.
Let's go back to the phones and speak now with Derek in Dallas. Hello, Derek.
Hello. My question today is what's going to happen to military infrastructure when, you know, gas gets to like $20 a gallon per se? How are we going to maintain our role as the world's police force when we have so many things like tanks, planes, jets, things like that, that run on, you know, fuel? How is that going to work out when we have to pay so much to be able to fuel these things and run the war machine?
That's a great question, and it's actually in Chapter 20, dollars per gallon. It's something I tackle. I talk about the military. There's a section in there. And the military is aware of its problem. Now, whether or not they're going to be able to fix it, I'm not really sure. You know, they use copious amounts of fuel, as you would think. I mean, in the future, they're just simply going to have to fly fewer sorties. There are going to be fewer places. And we're already realizing that now for reasons not related to energy. Most of them related to money. But energy is going to be another problem for the military in the future. But the military is aware of that, like I said, and they are right now working on a lot of technologies that will help them out. Now, if you go to Iraq or Afghanistan right now and you go to a command tent, those things typically are air conditioning for a couple reasons. Number one, because it's 130 degrees and the commanders can't well function at that kind of temperature. Number two, these tents are now full of computers that and satellite equipment that will break if the temperature's not kept cool. So these tents are generally air conditioned. And how do they run all the air conditioners and all these gizmos out there on giant diesel generators that they have to keep fuel coming to? And they just chew this stuff up. And basically, it gives the military this very long tail that they have to take care of petroleum-wise. Well, they're working on a project right now to make these command structures completely, we'll just call them green, but they're not going green for green's sake. They're going green for strategic sake. In the future, the military command posts, they'll run on solar panels that will whip out on the roof as they put these things together, and easily transportable wind turbines that will also attach to these tents and power a lot of the stuff that the diesel generators now power. And they'll also utilize wind drafts that come in through the bottom of the tent and stuff like that. So they're very aware of their problems. And like I said, that's just one of the projects the military is working on. Flying the kind of fleet of, say, B-52 bombers we have right now over the globe, which is just giant bomber that you probably know of, and it absolutely chews gas. I wish I had the number in front of me. Just to get this thing off the ground, it's tens of thousands of gallons. The military's aware, and certainly our presence as the police force of the world will be decreased as the price of energy goes up.
Bill in North Richland Hills wants to know about the viability of compressed natural gas as an alternative to gasoline in cars.
Well, the good news is that we have a lot more natural gas in America than we do oil. And, you know, we have had some big fines recently. And I do think, you know, in certain places, it's more popular than others to run cars. You may or may not know that in Utah, they have quite a few natural gas stations for cars. And there's a lot of people who drive natural gas cars in Salt Lake City area. The problem generally is that natural gas is a limited, finite resource and one that we use for all sorts of things. From heating our homes, I think that's what most people associate with, but people also don't realize that natural gas, we're basically eating it every day. Most of our fertilizer comes straight from natural gas. We make ammonia, which is the nitrogen that goes into the ground that grows our food, and we get the hydrogen atoms for that ammonia straight from natural gas. So basically we take natural gas out of the ground, make it straight into fertilizer. So there's a lot of demands on the natural gas supply, and adding our whole transportation infrastructure to those demands doesn't work.
So that would be short term at best.
Yes.
Okay. Let's go next to Greg in Irving. Hello, Greg.
Yes, hello. Mr. Steiner, listen, this is a wonderful conversation. I really appreciate your thinking on this subject. I want to go back to a comment you made about the reduction or perhaps death of some suburbs or exurbs and suggest an alternate ending, because mm-hmm. I think a lot of people are quick to kill the suburbs. They won't kill the suburbs. But if you drive around Dallas, you'll notice that there's these communities of development. I'm thinking like Plano or Addison, where these communities become the destination and become the walkable areas that you describe, where the downtown hub of Dallas may not be the destination. And so rather than people spreading out all over the place, there might be these networked areas that get developed as the place where you would work and play and live without ever going to the city core.
I think you're really onto something there, and I think that's what is going to happen. The suburbs with the more prescient planning than other ones are the ones that are going to profit. The ones that realize, hey, if we want to survive, we need a dense core where people can come and work, shop, go to school, and those places are the ones that are going to profit. The ones that lean hard on the big box model, where everyone's driving out to the edge of town to do all their shopping and driving 5 or 6 miles to get a gallon of milk, those are the places that will perish. But certainly, there are suburbs who totally realize what's going on here, and just out of consumer demand. I mean, boomers who are leaving their big homes in exurbs, you know, their kids are out of the house, they're done, they're on to their own lives. They want walkable neighborhoods, not because gas is expensive, but just because that's what they want. And so there's already demand for this, and some suburbs have already made the adjustment. And I think you'll see the ones that do make that adjustment, the ones that revive their downtowns or build new ones or build new promenades and stuff like that, those are the places that will profit in the future.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to David in Dallas. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my question.
Sure.
Actually, as an entrepreneur and a financier, one of the things that I think that's very interesting is there's plenty of energy in the United States. The problem is the infrastructure by which we deliver that energy. So we all agreed to drive cars rather than coal-fired steam locomotives. The fear comes from that transition of infrastructure. And so one of the things I'd love to hear Chris walk through is what type of transitional opportunities there will be. What types of fears will we have to swallow hard and work our way through as we transition from a gas, natural gas, coal-powered economy into what will follow?
Well, that's a pretty wide question, and you're right. There are so many fears associated with change in general, and when you start talking about gas prices of, say, $10 per gallon, it sets a lot of people off because that is change of the utmost magnitude. And I think people have grown to become comfortable in driving cheaply and living in big homes and stuff like that. And so when you tell them you have to move somewhere, and I'm not saying you have to. I'm just saying that, look, you know, to afford the type of life you have now, you won't be able to live way out there in the future. You'll have to move in. And I think people don't like to hear that. People don't like to hear change. But I think people will also be surprised at how well they and all of us adapt.
Well, there's been this really interesting debate about deciding what the next new energy infrastructure investment should be, especially that which is developed by the government, because we're not quite sure yet what the replacement might be for the system we have now that is relying most heavily on fossil fuels.
Right. Well, everybody's looking for the silver bullet. I mean, that's what you're talking about. I mean, everybody wants, well, hey, maybe we can just, you know, grow this switchgrass without fertilizers and it could just replace gasoline altogether. Or, you know, maybe we can just use hydrogen. But, of course, hydrogen has to come from somewhere. That's the problem with hydrogen. And normally, right now, it comes from natural gas, which is just another fossil fuel. So there's a lot of people looking for a lot of silver bullets. And it's my hypothesis and a lot of people's that, look, we don't have a silver bullet now. We're probably never going to get it. Oil was kind of a one-time gift that we got. And in order to keep using it and adjust in the future, basically, we just have to squeeze out a lot of efficiencies that right now our system doesn't take advantage of. I mean, we throw energy away in everything we do. And when we change how we live in the future, we'll still be using some of the old forms of energy. We're just going to use a lot less to do a lot more.
Let's go next to Irving, where we'll speak with Steve. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Interesting show. I appreciate the author's perspective, although I have to agree with one of the previous callers. I think it's a little optimistic and have for an additional reason. One is that, and you kind of just hit on it, other natural resources, both renewable and non-renewable, are also going to be peaking and declining if they aren't already, and a lot of that has to do with materials we take for granted now, like iron and steel, but also cadmium, lithium, things that we use to make solar panels, batteries. I think we're going to be hard-pressed to, in spite of our ingenuity, we're still in a limited biosphere, and we're testing the limits not only of fossil fuels, but all kinds of other things. And I think we're just in a mindset where we tend to be live a lot more in the old mindset. There'll always be something different. There'll always be something more. We just have to find it. Well, when we run out of things to find, we're in for, a hurt. I mean, peak everything, as Richard Heinberg kind of overstates it, but that's kind of an issue that kind of cuts my optimism a little bit on this. this subject.
Well, Chris, how are you able to stay so optimistic, having looked at this so closely?
Well, I mean, a couple things. I think some people, I mean, James Howard Kunstler wrote an important book called The Long Emergency, and basically he kind of forecasts a very doomy future for us. Within 10 years, he said, and he wrote that book back in 2005, I think, as far as what will happen. He predicted that, you know, the oil economy will completely crumble and that basically we'll be fighting for the last potato scraps in the streets for the next 10 years. He and a lot of other people kind of ignore the fact that there is still a lot of energy left. Granted, we are at the peak point, and there are 2 billion people entering the global middle class over the next 30 years. Right now, there's only a billion of those people right now that live lives like we do in America. You know, just in China alone, you're going to add another America worth of energy consumption by 2040. So clearly, the price of energy is going to go up. But I think people downplay our ingenuity and the market's ability to adjust how much energy we use. I mean, the old paradigms are going to go away. And the last caller was talking about we're always looking for the next thing. And he's like, well, there isn't a next thing. And I think to a large degree he's right. There isn't a next thing. But the important thing to realize is that how much we can squeeze out of what we have, and those efficiencies will come on track. And I think this gets back to the gas tax thing, and I think in the long run it could only help us if, say, government stepped in, and the government's a giant wild card here, and said, look, we're just going to start charging more for gasoline. A, we need the money because we know they do, and they're not charging enough. 18.4 cents is the federal gas tax, and that was made when gas was a dollar. It doesn't go up. It's static. So gas goes to $4, it's still 18.4 cents. So that has to be fixed. And they could, in effect, spur change in America, in the world, if we were to institute a higher gas tax. Now, nothing radical, but maybe a dollar phased in over quarters, phased in over 6 months, over the course of 2 or 3 years, something like that, I think will go a long way to bringing the type of indelible change that we are going to need in the future.
And at what point do you imagine we will stop talking about the price of oil?
Gosh, that's a long time away right now, just because, you know, it plays such a giant role. But I do think, you know, the end game here, be it $20 per gallon gasoline, and I think when you get to that point, what you kind of hope for is that the price of gas becomes less and less of an issue because we'll have moved on. But, you know, there are people who say, look, oil users will disappear before oil does, meaning that we'll find the next thing, we'll find new things to do. But the important thing to realize is that we need incentives. Capitalism needs incentives, and the incentive will be the price, the rising price of gasoline.
Christopher Steiner's new book is called $20 per Gallon, How the Inevitable Rise in the Price of Gasoline Will Change Our Lives for the Better. Chris, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.